from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. This is Backstory with the American History Guys.
Welcome to the show. I'm Ed Ayers, here with Peter Onuf.
Hey, Ed.
And Brian Ballow.
Hey, Ed.
When Noah Lani Arista was growing up in Hawaii in the 1970s and 1980s, the Hawaiian language was something that was spoken mostly by old people.
I mean, you know, you heard stories from your parents. Yes, Grandma would always speak in Hawaiian when she didn't want us to understand what she was saying.
Arista's grandmother spent the last few months of her life receiving care at home.
There were days when she couldn't remember English, but she could remember Hawaiian. So that's when I realized, wow, in my own family, if I learn Hawaiian, there's going to be a continuous chain of people who spoke Hawaiian. Practically.
When Arista was in college in the 1980s, she decided to learn her family's native language. Until then, the opportunities for formal instruction in Hawaiian had been limited. Since 1896, the language had been marginalized in the public schools, and only now was it experiencing something of a rebirth. Arista would go on to study history, and her language skills would give her a whole new perspective on her island's past.
As a kid, Arista had learned a version of Hawaiian history that's basically the same as mainland American kids learn, if they learn one at all.
So you learn about the arrival of Captain Cook in 1778, followed by the unification of the kingdom, the archipelago under Kamehameha I, then the arrival of the missionaries in 1820, and there's this sort of like gray portion that happens until sometime around 1893, the kingdom is overthrown.
It may be gray, Arista says, but its shape is unmistakable, that of a steady and relatively unchallenged march toward annexation by the United States. Arista refers to it as a progress narrative.
The progress narrative seems to depend upon Kanaka Maoli people, native people, sort of going with the flow, agreeing to everything that looks progressive.
That version of Hawaiian history started to unravel for Arista when she was in graduate school. There, she was working on a project translating Hawaiian language newspapers for other scholars to use.
I would go every Saturday from 9 a.m. to 12, along with a bunch of other sort of graduate students and several native speakers, and we would read Hawaiian language newspapers every weekend, and we would summarize each article. Some of the articles were advertisements, some were chants, some were mo'olelo or histories.
What Arista found in those newspapers ran counter to the idea that Hawaii's annexation by America was inevitable and that native Hawaiians welcomed the political change taking place there. In the papers from 1845, for instance, she discovered a series of petitions addressed to King Kamehameha III, urging him to fight against the growing influence of the missionaries and their descendants.
There are all these petitions from Maka'ainana, from Hawaiian citizens, asking the king not to allow so many foreigners to swear the oath of office. And the words that they use are Oliloa ana ilako i Hawaii, or they shall become, you know, Hawaiian nationals is what I can imagine, but Oliloa ana ilako i Hawaii sounds like, or they shall become Hawaiians, like in our place. So there's a high degree of suspicion among the native population for foreign officers serving in government.
The people's suspicions were well-founded. American missionaries and businessmen came to dominate the Hawaiian House of Nobles and the King's Cabinet. They used their legislative power to redistribute native lands and to control the economy. And their descendants became the driving force behind the deposition of Queen Liliuokalani and the annexation of Hawaii to the United States at the end of the 19th century. But for more than 150 years, all that has been missing from the historical record.
You know, the entire petition drive, it's not in any narrative. You know, and for every other kind of moment in Hawaiian history, you know, I imagine there's going to be moments like this that we have yet to uncover. This is what's so amazing.
Today, Noa Lani Arista is a professor of history at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And surprisingly, she is the first and only member of the university's history department who is a fluent reader and speaker of Hawaiian. Arista hopes that distinction will be a short-lived one. She is energetically training her own graduate students to read Hawaiian. Thanks to their translation projects, hundreds of thousands of formerly missing pages of Hawaiian history, written by the native Hawaiians who lived it, are coming to light. Those pages are reshaping the history that future generations of children will learn about their islands.
For those of us who live on the mainland, islands are something we often tend to think about as destinations, as places to visit, perhaps to take a break from our ordinary lives, and then to leave again. They're places on the periphery, and that's borne out not only in the way we draw our maps, but also in the way we write our history.
For the rest of the hour, we're taking the peripheral and we're making it central. It's a backstory episode all about islands in American history. In the spirit of Noelani Arista's work at the Hawaiian Language Archives, we set out in search of stories that tend to slip through the cracks of American history, and we have a few of those stories for you today.
You'll hear about a man who took over an island in Michigan and declared himself king, and about Chinese immigrants held in a kind of island purgatory after crossing the Pacific. But first, we're going to turn from Hawaii to another island territory with more than 3.5 million American citizens who nonetheless have no voting representatives in Congress and no say in presidential elections, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico.
In the late 1940s, Puerto Rico was at a crossroads. For almost 50 years, it had been a colony of the U.S., but with colonial subjects in Asia and Africa throwing off their European rulers, many Puerto Ricans were looking forward to a new status for their island as well. Some wanted statehood, others more autonomy. Some demanded outright independence. Now, we know how this debate played out. What isn't as well known here on the mainland is the turmoil that preceded Puerto Rico's transition to Commonwealth status.
Throughout the 1930s, the radical wing of the independence faction, known as the Nationalist Party, violently clashed with the colonial regime in Puerto Rico. In 1936, that party's leader, a man named Pedro Albizu Campos, was imprisoned by American authorities for sedition. Our next story picks up 10 years later, when Albizu Campos was released and his followers saw one last chance to shape Puerto Rico's future. Here's backstory producer Nina Ernest with that story.
When Pedro Albizu Campos was released from prison in 1947, he picked up right where he had left off, giving fiery speeches in support of independence.
Y decirle al mundo entero que Estados Unidos es una nación violadora de la Constitución de las Naciones Unidas.
But Puerto Rico had changed in his 10-year absence. When he first rose to prominence in the 20s and 30s, support for independence was at an all-time high. Now, many political leaders were turning toward a new model, one that meant more autonomy for Puerto Rico, with continued oversight by the United States. It was a path favored by a savvy politician named Luis Muñoz Marin, who recognized that Puerto Rico's contributions to the Allied war effort had given it leverage to negotiate a more favorable status with the U.S. He was at that very moment on the verge of becoming the island's first democratically elected governor. And in the summer of 1950, the U.S. Congress did pass a law allowing Puerto Ricans to vote on a new constitution, one that would eventually cement the new Commonwealth status.
There's no way Puerto Ricans are not going to move toward ratifying the constitution that is going to be presented to Congress.
This is Jairi Franqui Rivera, a historian at Hunter College in New York. He says Albizu Campos regarded the constitution as another form of colonialism, but also realized that the political winds had turned against him.
He realized that he wasn't a relevant figure anymore politically. So he had to, if he wanted to determine the future of Puerto Rico, which is something that he wanted to determine the future of Puerto Rico, he had to do something drastic.
His desperation was fueled by a repressive gag law that had gone into effect months after he had returned from prison. Many scholars believe it was created to keep the nationalists in line. It prohibited writing, discussing, even singing about an independent Puerto Rico, or from displaying a Puerto Rican flag. Albizu Campos decided that the only way to win Puerto Rico's independence was to fight for it. he and the Nationalists planned a revolt. Nelson Dennis is the author of a forthcoming book about this rebellion.
What they planned to do was to have an island-wide set of actions where they assaulted the police precincts to hopefully get some weapons, which they didn't have many of, and then they would retreat to the central town of Utuado, which was nestled in a ring of mountains, pretty much in the center of Puerto Rico, and they were hoping to hold out for about 2 weeks.
Now, the hope here wasn't to win a military victory. The Nationalists were a small force, and they knew it.
It's important to emphasize that Albizu Campos and the Nationalists knew that militarily it was ridiculous to attempt to confront the United States, you know, the most powerful country in the world. What they needed to do, and they needed to do it with some urgency, was to get world attention and specifically the UN Decolonization Committee to focus on what they considered the colonial situation in Puerto Rico.
In this era of decolonization, the newly formed United Nations had a special committee to help that process along. The Nationalists wanted their help. And so, on October 30th, 1950, Nationalists assaulted police precincts in 7 towns. They stormed Governor Muñoz Marín's mansion, La Fortaleza, in San Juan. In one town, Jayuya, Nationalists even managed to lift the Puerto Rican flag, in defiance of the gag law, and declare for the Free Republic of Puerto Rico. The countermeasures were swift. President Harry Truman declared martial law. Muñoz Marín called in the U.S.-trained Puerto Rican National Guard. And most striking of all, those National Guardsmen bombed the towns of Jayuya and Utuado. It was the only time, says Nelson Dennis, that the U.S. military carried out a bombing campaign against its own citizens.
So that's how the United States dealt with it very quickly. 5,000 National Guardsmen, a bombing of 2 towns, and a clampdown on any media attention to it. President Truman tried to dismiss everything, the revolution that happened in 1950, as, quote unquote, an incident between Puerto Ricans. But that didn't seem all that credible when two of those Puerto Ricans showed up in Blair House and tried to assassinate him.
Outside Blair House, the president's temporary Washington home, extreme fanatics of the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party try to force their way in, guns blazing, to assassinate the president of the United States. When the 3-minute shooting is over, assassin Griselio Torresola lies dead on the Blair House lawn, and White House policeman Leslie Coffelt is dying a few feet away.
The assassination attempt took place on November 1st. By the following day, Puerto Rican forces had the revolt under control. In the end, 28 people had been killed, most of them Nationalists. Between 1 and 2,000 Puerto Ricans were arrested, including Pedro Albizu Campos. And once again, the revolutionary went back to prison. He would spend yet another decade of his life there. A few months after the revolt, 76% of Puerto Ricans voted in favor of drafting a new constitution that would grant them some autonomy under the Commonwealth status. Since Puerto Rico was soon to be ostensibly in Puerto Rican hands, the United Nations would no longer consider the island a colony that demanded its attention.
At that point, it was like game, set, match. It's like, hey, the game's over. Everybody take your marbles and go home. There's nothing more to say.
Despite his failure in 1950, Pedro Albizu Campos has not been forgotten. To the contrary, he is still widely revered. Nelson Dennis is among many, especially in the Puerto Rican diaspora, who admire him for standing up to the U.S. when the odds were stacked against him.
Even though he didn't win that military battle, he won, in my view, the moral victory, the moral battle of showing the world what is right and what should be.
Harry Franky Rivera is less laudatory. He sees Albizu Campos as something of a conservative, cultish figure whose followers had a nostalgic vision of a Puerto Rican nation that harkened back to a time before U.S. rule.
They were completely defeated and discredited philosophically. Muñoz Marín is offering a peaceful path towards modernity to create a new Puerto Rico, a new Puerto Rican. And what the Nationalists are offering is going back in the past.
As for the legacy of the 1950 revolt, Franky Rivera says the territorial government's swift response to it showed Congress that Puerto Ricans could govern themselves. And it demonstrated to Puerto Rican voters that Muñoz Marín was an effective leader. So perhaps Albizu Campos did help shape the future of Puerto Rico, just not in the way he would have liked.
Nina Ernest is one of our producers. Helping her tell that story was Harry Franky Rivera from the Center of Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. And Nelson Dennis. He's the author of the forthcoming book, War Against All Puerto Ricans, Revolution and Terror in America's Colony. You're listening to Backstory. I'm Brian Ballow.
I'm Peter Onuf.
And I'm Ed Ayers. Today on the show, we're casting off in search of islands with stories to tell about the American past. In 1844, the founder of the Mormon religion, Joseph Smith, was killed in Nauvoo, Illinois. Schisms quickly formed among his followers. Brigham Young and Sidney Rigdon, apostles to Smith, represented one rivalry. Young led his followers to Utah, now home to millions of devotees. Rigdon led his followers to found a branch of the church in Pennsylvania.
But there was a third would-be leader who emerged, and his name was James Strang. He was a publisher and a lawyer who claimed that, like Smith, he was a prophet receiving messages directly from God. Many Mormons who had flocked to Smith because of his powers of divination now turned to Strang. Mormons at this time were being expelled from their communities in both Illinois and Missouri, so Strang took a few hundred of his followers and struck out. But he didn't go east. He didn't go west. In fact, he went north. Their destination? A patch of land in Lake Michigan called Beaver Island. Backstory producer Andrew Parsons has that story.
No one really knows why James Strang chose Beaver Island in particular, but one thing was sure.
Beaver Island had a lot of lumber, and the fishing was really, really good.
This is Sandra Birdsall.
And I live on Beaver Island.
Birdsall is an officer at the Beaver Island Historical Society and is putting together an exhibit on James Strang. We reached her on vacation in South Carolina on, you guessed it, an island. She says the government had surveyed the nearly 56-square-mile Beaver Island in the late 1840s and put cheap land for sale. It's lush, remote, and beautiful, advantageous to industrious pioneers. In 1848, James Strang and a few hundred of his followers bought some land and quickly set up a colony on the scenic shores.
The Mormons had been thrown out of everywhere else in the U.S. that they were, and they came to Beaver Island thinking it would be secluded and safe. And the island was financially very successful. It was a very industrious group of people that came.
John Hamer, editor of a book about schisms in the Church of Latter-day Saints, and a Mormon himself, says that secluded and safe was important after years of persecution.
If you were going to go and establish a new Mormon kingdom, islands kind of have this sense that they are autonomous.
But Beaver Island wasn't entirely autonomous. There were other people. A small trading outpost was there, as well as a large fishing community on nearby Mackinac Island. And it's not like Strang didn't recognize that. He thought that apart from farming and fishing, Mormons could trade, which would help build a prosperous community. The new neighbors, however, weren't having any of it. They had been eyeing the good fishing on Beaver Island after overfishing the shores of Mackinac.
There were conflicts right away. So the non-Mormons did not like the influx of Mormons.
The Strangites were often assaulted by Mackinac Islanders and at times fought back.
There was one early conflict with a Mormon and a shopkeeper that ended up with a man being shot. And I think that was the very first and sort of endemic then to what the attitude was between the two groups.
Newspapers picked up on this conflict and started publishing exaggerated stories about Mormon mischief, theft, piracy, and violence. Soon, a newspaper war was started. Strangites shot back in the pages of their own daily, the Northern Islander. In one case, it called a reporter from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Mr. Plain Liar Jr.
"We will assure him a good horse whipping," administered according to Mormon law in the presence of a multitude of witnesses.
Now, early on, Strang wasn't even on Beaver Island as the tensions mounted. In 1849, he took a long trip east to recruit people to the settlement. But when he came back the following year, things escalated a bit more. Now, this man who claimed to be prophet was crowning himself king.
People reported it fairly quickly, and so that was well known, and that was, a subject of both disdain and also ridicule fairly early on. Although, technically, he's not king of the island. He's king of the kingdom of God on earth. But, you know, it was easy for the outsiders to say, you know, he's king of Beaver Island.
Strang began issuing edicts to the rest of the island. Most were about living piously. No gambling, alcohol, coffee, or tea. But eventually, he ordered everyone on the island to convert to his church or else be jailed. And that's when Washington got involved. The situation landed on the desk of President Millard Fillmore. He ordered a federal prosecutor to do something about Strang.
It's able to go up the flagpole pretty fast. And so they decide that one of the ways that they maybe will be able to stop the settlement up there is by simply arresting Strang himself and then trying him for all kinds of different things like tampering with the mail and illegal trespass on federal lands.
The government's case quickly got bogged down in details of frontier law and unreliable witnesses, but Strang was prepared. He had a much clearer defense, religious freedom.
Strang was actually very eloquent in the trial, kind of showed all of his prosecutors to be persecutors, and so essentially, ultimately they had to acquit him and release him, which made it really hard to prosecute him after that.
Not only did Strang survive the charges, the trial propelled him to greater influence in the region. Many newspapers now gave him favorable press, and he even got elected state senator representing 26 Michigan counties twice.
And there were people talking about him in the press as possibly running for governor.
For a few years, it looked like Strang had pulled it off. His settlement was economically prosperous, and statewide, he was respected. But back on Beaver Island, he earned a share of enemies. His edicts created dissenters among his followers, including requiring women to wear bloomers and punishments that included flogging.
And so essentially a group of dissenters, ultimately, they had no capacity to arrest him and have any of the charges stick, and so they formed a conspiracy to assassinate him.
On June 16th, 1856, a warship named the USS Michigan pulled up to Beaver Island, and the captain asked to meet with Strang.
And Strang shows up on the dock, and the two assassins are waiting for him.
He was shot in the back by two disgruntled followers. In events that Birdsall says implicate the federal government, the shooters boarded the USS Michigan and were carted off to the mainland, where they faced a small fine by a local judge. Strang was rushed to the Mormon city of Waree, Wisconsin, and died there a few weeks later. An unruly mob destroyed the settlement and forced all the Mormons left on Beaver Island onto boats.
They were then dropped off all around the edges of Lake Michigan in Wisconsin and Michigan and Illinois and Indiana in small groups so that they wouldn't be able to regather easily. And so they're total refugees. They're destitute. They aren't connected to each other and just separated and leaderless.
Now, this episode on Beaver Island might sound like a quirky hidden piece of American history. Honestly, it was for Backstory staff when we first found it, but
for us, it was a tragedy.
This is David August.
I'm a member of the Remnant Strangite Church.
August says there are only about 100 fully practicing Strangites in the United States today. Most people, even other Mormons, assume the sect was extinguished when they were forced off Beaver Island. But August says that most people miss a lot of context when telling the story of James Strang. First, this was the American frontier, where many religions and utopian communities were started. Second, the church is largely built around his teachings about social justice. And he says even Strang's coronation has precedent. Both Joseph Smith and later Brigham Young did the same.
In all those cases, it's not a king like it displaces the government of the United States and establishes a kingdom that way. It's a spiritual affiliation to someone who is a prophet is also king. It's not an uncommon thing if you look at the Old Testament, David was a king, Solomon was a king, Christ was a king. But it's much easier and more fun to just say, yeah, he was a crazy guy. He thought he was king, you know?
John Hamer says many in the press, even scholars, don't feel an obligation to take strings seriously. And that, he sees as something of a double standard.
There's a lot of ways with which, let's say, the Joseph Smith story itself, the idea that there was an ancient record buried on gold plates and angels and all that kind of thing, and people believing that very literally. But historians of religion and religious studies don't go in and talk to, you know, people in Utah as if all this stuff is ridiculous. They talk to them respectfully. They take their beliefs seriously. And that just hasn't been the case largely for historians dealing with the Strangites, possibly because there's so few of them, or people maybe think that they're extinct.
Maybe the story of James Strang is a little strange, but in the vast seas of American history, it's certainly not an island unto itself.
Andrew Parsons is a producer on our show.
Guys, that story of James Strang and the Mormon diaspora moving to this island, Beaver Island, is a fascinating story. And it evokes for me, fantasies and memories that go back to early childhood. Islands were the most exciting, romantic place that I could imagine. Of course, we read books like Treasure Island, but the idea of a space that was delimited and could be your own.
Yeah, I remember seeing Swiss Family Robinson, the Disney movie, theater, and fighting off the pirates with the rolling logs and all that.
I remember that scene.
I felt so vicariously invested in a movie. And it was something about being able to defend the boundaries of who you were, and of course, the family.
Nice.
So, yeah, apparently Disney knows how to tap the psyche.
That's right. And that point you make, Ed, about defense, I think is really crucial in the story of James Strang. Mormons had, as you know, suffered tremendous persecution and abuse in New York and Ohio and ultimately in Illinois and Missouri, and trying to find a safe place so that they could practice their religion. And of course, it was not just going to church on Sunday for Mormons. It was a whole way of life. They desperately needed an island. And you could say that in some ways, the successful Mormon experiment in Salt Lake was a virtual island in the midst of the great American desert.
They used land as the ocean, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You go so far away that nobody, unless they were really determined to persecute you, could get there. But it sounds like Strang wasn't quite so fortunate in a time when an island's basically vulnerable to anybody with a boat.
But I think that's the point, because islands are simultaneously these defensible points. But I think more important than that is that islands in the early modern period and to the present day are nodes or points of connection with the larger world. This is, I think, the paradox. On the one hand, an island is a place you get away to an island, and in fact, that's the lure in tourism.
On the other hand, you're saying, Peter, islands used to be kind of way stations, crucial ones, right, in an international trade.
That's absolutely right. So the advantage of an island is its openness. Is the fact that it can connect many places. It's a way of linking to the world and exploiting the world, and that is through commerce and trade.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, if you think about the way that you would control the seas, it's basically making man-made islands in the forms of ships.
Yeah, good point.
You know, a ship is a portable island, self-contained, isolated, defensible. But the point here is that you can actually take it from one place to another with all the guns and food that you need. And now you think about Herman Melville and the great whaling voyages. I think they actually saw the ships as islands. So in a watery world, which the world was until the middle of the 19th century.
Yes, it was indeed.
I think islands had a role that we can't really quite imagine today, in which now they just seem places that you can fly to get away in a very transitory, kind of shallow, so to speak, sort of way.
And Ed, don't stop with the 19th century, because as America became a global military power in the 20th century, islands were crucial. They were called fueling stations. Yeah, and then after World War II, they became bases for aircraft. So the American presence well into the 20th century on Guam and the Philippines and all of these islands is very much linked to the kind of interconnectedness that Peter was talking about. Mm-hmm. In this case, a flat-out military interconnectedness.
Yeah, as much as the United States enjoyed its status as a citadel isolated from any other real power, it needed to expose itself by establishing the coaling station there in Hawaii. And it both gave it an enormous advantage in participating in the Pacific trade, but at the same time, it makes it vulnerable.
And you mentioned vulnerable, Ed, and we're talking about independence, autonomy, and interdependence. And think about how America entered World War II. It was the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which was intended to make America militarily strong, but it was the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of entry into a world war, the ultimate interdependence.
Yeah. I think what all this suggests, guys, is that islands are part of the whole world of everywhere, yet islands remain in our kind of our deep memories and our psyches, places of escape, of where you can fulfill your own individual destiny, where you won't be subject to the influence of others. I think that's beautifully epitomized by Thomas More's Utopia, published in Latin in 1516, in which he imagines an ideal society. Utopia means no place. And in fact, he's reimagining the world by projecting this ideal society onto an island, which is a world unto itself.
It's time for another break, but stay with us. When we get back, we'll hear the stories of East Asian migrants yearning to breathe free, but stuck on an island in San Francisco Bay.
You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute. This is Backstory. I'm Ed Ayers.
I'm Brian Ballow.
And I'm Peter Onuf. Today on the show, we're reflecting on stories from the American past that take place on islands.
Our next story is set on Angel Island, a small island in the chilly waters of San Francisco Bay, not too far from its more famous cousin, Alcatraz. But Angel Island is more often compared to an island on the other coast, Ellis Island. That's because from 1910 to 1940, it was the site of a U.S. immigration station that processed more than 1 million travelers crossing the Pacific.
Now, throughout this period, the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 was still the law of the land. That act made it illegal for Chinese laborers to enter the country, but did include a few exceptions: teachers, diplomats, some merchants, and the families of U.S. citizens. And that last category, families of citizens, resulted in an elaborate cat-and-mouse game with young would-be migrants, most of them men, attempting to bluff their way past immigration officials on Angel Island by claiming kinship with Chinese Americans in the U.S.
Immigration officials did their best to ferret out these so-called paper sons, subjecting Chinese immigrants to extensive interrogations and checking to make sure all their claims held up. And while they did, the migrants themselves were held captive in a kind of purgatory. Whereas the average immigrant on Ellis Island spent about 5 hours being processed, Chinese immigrants passing through Angel Island often found themselves detained in crowded wooden barracks for days, weeks, and months on end.
Judy Young is a historian in Santa Cruz whose father was among those processed at Angel Island. A few years ago, she co-authored a book about the immigrant experience there that included some remarkable documents, poems written on the walls of those wooden barracks by the Chinese men who waited there for processing.
Immigration officials, they saw this as graffiti. They then painted over the writing. And after they started painting over, then the Chinese would brush the characters onto the wall, and then they would carve the outline of the characters and scoop out the wood so that you will have these impressions of the characters. And when you paint over them, then you could still see the words. I remember making my first trip to Angel Island to see these poems. It was dark, it was dingy, it was smelly, there was trash all over the grounds. I could still make out the impressions of Chinese words all over the walls. I could even read some of the words.
This place is called an island of immortals, when in fact this mountain wilderness is a prison. Once you see the open net, why throw yourself in? It is only because of empty pockets I can do nothing else.
They're locked up on this lonely island in this wooden building, waiting to be admitted into the country, seeing the skyline, the buildings across the bay, knowing that Oakland or San Francisco, whichever way they were facing, was that close, and yet not being able to reach there and not knowing how long it would be before they might be admitted or, heavens forbid, that they may be turned back and deported in the end.
I used to admire the land of America as a country of abundance. Now, on an extended sojourn in jail, I am subject to the ordeals of prison life. I look up and see Oakland so close by. I wish to go back to my motherland to carry the farmer's hoe. Discontent fills my belly, and it is difficult for me to sleep. I just write these few lines to express what is on my mind.
It is noisy because of the many country folk, and there are watchmen guarding during the night. I gaze to the south at the hospital and look to the west at the army camp. What happiness is there in this?
A lot of the poems also complained about the mistreatment that they felt, the harsh laws, the discrimination, the physical exam, and the whole interrogation process, and the feeling of being treated as criminals, that you had to prove that you were innocent rather than the other way around.
America has power, but not justice. In prison, we were victimized as if we were guilty, given no opportunity to explain. It was really brutal. I bow my head in reflection, but there is nothing I can do.
They understood that because China was a weak country and did not have good diplomatic relations with the U.S., that they were unable to stop the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, that was the reason why they were being subjected to the discriminatory harsher treatment at Angel Island.
How was I to know that the Western barbarians had lost their hearts and reason? With 100 kinds of oppressive laws, they mistreat us Chinese. It is still not enough. After being interrogated and investigated several times, we also have to have our chests examined while naked. Our countrymen suffer this treatment, all because our country's power cannot yet expand. If there comes a day when China will be united, I will surely cut out the heart and bowels of the Western barbarian.
The ocean encircles a lone peak. Rough terrain surrounds this prison. There are few birds flying over the cold hills. The wild goose messenger cannot find its way. I have been detained and obstacles have been put my way for half a year. Melancholy and hate gather on my face. Now that I must return to my country, I have toiled like the Jingwei bird in vain.
I think if it wasn't for the poems and the discovery of the poems, this history about immigration through Angel Island would be lost. I say this because if the buildings had been destroyed, the poetry had been lost, we would have no record of what happened at Angel Island and what people felt about that experience.
Over 100 poems are on the walls. Looking at them, they are all pining at the delayed progress. What can one sad person say to another? unfortunate travelers everywhere wish to commiserate. Gain or lose, how is one to know what is predestined? Rich or poor, who is to say it is not the will of heaven? Why should one complain if he is detained and imprisoned here? From ancient times, heroes often were the first ones to face adversity.
Judy Young is professor emeritus at UC Santa Cruz and author of Island, Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island. Today, the immigration station is a National Historic Landmark open to visitors. You can still see the poetry of Chinese detainees on the walls.
I got the blues from my baby down by the San Francisco Bay. An ocean liner took him so far away.
If you're just joining us, this is Backstory. Today on the show, we've been island hopping across American history. For our final story today, we're going to answer a question that's been bugging me for years. Here it is. Why is Thousand Island dressing called Thousand Island dressing?
Oh, man, that's heavy. Now, the one thing that everybody seems to agree on is that this particular backstory took place in the early 1900s and has something to do with the Thousand Islands region of the St. Lawrence River between New York State and Ontario, Canada, as you know. But beyond that, the stories diverge. Here's one theory. A guy named Oscar Cherokee, the maitre d' of New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel, whipped up the dressing while working on his boss's yacht. Cherokee and his boss, a guy named George Bolt, were vacationing in the Thousand Islands, and Cherokee apparently threw some mayo in with some chopped up tomatoes, and voila, Thousand Island dressing was born.
Another theory has it that the inventor was actually a woman named Sophie Lalonde, the wife of a charter fishing captain who concocted the dressing not for salad, but rather for the fish that her husband's clients had caught that day. And according to a third story, Thousand Island dressing was invented by an actress named May Irwin, famous for performing the first ever on-screen kiss in a 47-second Thomas Edison short. Several years after the kiss, she gave the recipe to a chef at Chicago's Blackstone Hotel, where she was performing. Both of them had spent time at hotels in the Thousand Islands, and so named it after their favorite vacation spot.
To figure out which of these theories is most credible, we called in someone who knows his way around food and history. Ben Davison is a historian here at the University of Virginia and a chef. Ben, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be here.
So what do you think? Which theory do you put your money on?
You know, if I had to make a guess, I think they're probably all true in their own way. No, it's not a cop-out. But if anything, I think the key factor is that this all involves people who are frequenting upstate New York hotels and resorts.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a time when upstate New York was the resort capital. 100 years ago, travel was still a real undertaking.
Yeah.
You couldn't just get on a plane and go to Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
So the wealthy would go to really this kind of bucolic place in upstate New York, and places that were earmarked as sort of really being a place where you can get healthy, get out of the city air, eat well, really commune with nature. And it was a really popular place to go.
Okay, well, let's drill down into this question a little more and try to throw out some possibilities. So salads or fish?
My guess would be salads.
Why?
For a long time, really throughout the 19th century, Americans ate terribly. It was impossible, really, in major cities to get vegetables. By the time they got to market in New York,
mm-hmm.
they'd be wilted, crushed. For a lot of wealthy Americans, being able to afford salad greens that were still intact,
yeah.
that was a big deal. So if you were entertaining people on a private yacht like Bolt was,
mm-hmm.
when supposedly his chef came up with this recipe, the first thing you do, because these would all be local elites, your friends, wealthy people, you'd serve a salad. It's summer. And this was really sort of the height of sophistication.
Okay, so I'm going with salad over fish. I buy that. Why dressings in the first place?
You know, we're kind of spoiled now. that we can go to the store and get these like kind of sweet, supple, sour, you know, mescaline and spring mix, arugula.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that 100 years
pre-washed.
Ago. Pre-washed. Right. You know, the greens you're buying, they're bitter. They're just like, it's what can really be grown. Like New York doesn't really take to spring mix. You know, it takes to endives and chicories, real tough watercress.
So you have this delicacy that's so untasty that you need to come up with a dressing?
Kind of, yeah. And
there's
really
no way
around
it. Oh, boy,
this
is the lives of rich and famous.
But remember, it's all about style and sophistication. You know, it's really about the like showing off that you can afford this thing that isn't really that good to begin with.
Okay, so you're cruising on Bolt's yacht through the Thousand Islands on the Canadian border, and the chef, how does he present this Thousand Island dressing?
My honest guess is, and this is to someone who used to cook for a living,
mm-hmm.
he probably got a pile of greens from some farmer nearby, and he had this stuff. And he's like, all right, taste it. Oh, God, this is horribly bitter. I guarantee this is how it went down. And, you know, mayonnaise is a great masking agent for bitterness. The fat, the salt, the acid really helps tame those kind of like wild, bitter, kind of dense greens.
Yeah.
But, you know, mayonnaise by itself, at that point, was already becoming passé as a salad dressing.
So plain mayonnaise wasn't cutting it
anymore. So you needed to kind of gussy that up.
Uh-huh.
And that's where the ketchup comes in, or this, like, tomato condiment. And, you know, the funny thing about ketchup is that 100 years ago, if you said ketchup, people would ask you what kind. Because ketchup, for a long time, really referred to a style of sauces that was more like a chutney.
I see.
The most popular ketchup in America, say, 1900... would have been mushroom ketchup or walnut ketchup.
Wow.
Now, if you think about other really common salad dressings at the time, you know, they'll mix mayonnaise with like walnut ketchup and they'll dress that on some ungodly combinations. You know, a really popular salad mixed cottage cheese, chives, and bananas. He probably just thought, all right, well, this is how I have always sort of treated these things. The tomato is sweet, the mayonnaise, it brings out a lot of good flavors. I mean, we still like Thousand Island dressing because it's good.
Well, speaking of that, and I don't want to be too classist here, but it seems like Thousand Island dressings has come down a couple of notches in terms of class status. How did that go down?
My guess is at the time, 100 years ago, when this is sort of coming out, this was something that really was on elite tables.
Yes.
It's slowly diffused, like a lot of things. You know, it has a lot to do with the ways that, you know, especially after the Second World War, Americans started eating the way the wealthy ate, but in a very particular way. They started really going after ingredients and cooking styles that were associated with comfort and affluence. You know, some nutritionists have argued that one of the reasons why the working class 100 years ago has such a short lifespan was their diet was effectively, you know, some combination of lard and cornmeal.
Yeah. Do you think that when Thousand Island dressing became a bit déclassé, or a nicer word is diffused, as you put it, do you think part of that was that it sounded so exotic that people thought they were actually eating something quite special?
Absolutely. I mean, the Thousand Islands, for a lot of Americans, resonated with this idea of relaxation, comfort. You're traveling somewhere.
Yeah.
And a place that had, for, you know, the better part of the latter half of the 19th century, been a designated special resort location.
Right, right.
And then as all these ingredients become more available and certain tastes become sort of stratified and ossified, well, then it says, oh, it's a Thousand Island dressing.
Well, Ben, thanks for addressing this incredibly important issue here on Backstory Today.
My pleasure.
This is my island in the sun, where my fever has soared since I have begun.
Ben Davison is a historian at the University of Virginia. He's currently working on a history of supermarkets in America.
And that is going to do it for us today. But if you've still got island fever, drop in at our website, where we've got a whole lot more about island history. And while you're there, take a minute to weigh in on our upcoming show about speed. What counted as fast when you were a kid, and how has that changed in your lifetime? We're also on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at Backstory Radio. Whatever you do, don't be a stranger.
Today's episode of Backstory was produced by Tony Field, Nina Ernest, Andrew Parsons, Kelly Jones, Emily Gaddick, and Robert Armengol. Jamal Milner is our engineer. We had help from Coley Elhai. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham. Special thanks this week to our readers, Charles Laughlin, James Wang, James Scales, and Lingwei Zhang.
Major support for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional funding is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment, and by History Channel, history made every day.
Brian Ballow is professor of history at the University of Virginia. Peter Onuf is professor of history emeritus at UVA and senior research fellow at Monticello. Ed Ayers is president and professor of history at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
Backstory is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.